Good morning. I'd like to call the committee, the Senate Committee on Health and Human Services to order. And it is Wednesday, March 27th, 2024. And we do have a quorum present. Today, we will begin with Senate File 4584, which is Senator Mann's bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Senate File 4584 makes technical changes to the Minnesota Medication Repository Program. It is an amazing program we've had in Minnesota now since 2020 that takes unused, unopened medications, donated, and redistributes them to people who otherwise would go without their medications due to financial barriers. Since its inception, they have donated over 666,000 days of medications to patients all over Minnesota. So in the last 4 years, they've learned how to make this program leaner and meaner, and these are the technical changes to do that. I have with me today Dr. Rowan Mann, one of Roundtable's founders, and Dr. Rachel Rockwell, the managing director and pharmacist in charge, to answer any questions people may have.
Great. Well, welcome to the committee, and whoever is planning to testify, if you could state your name for the record and begin.
Madam Chair.
Oh, Senator Mann.
She's just here for questions.
Oh, okay.
For the sake of time, we don't have to testify.
Oh, all right. We will just move. Do people have questions about Senator Mann's bill? Maybe you could just tell us a little bit more about why or how the changes came about that you've got incorporated in this bill and, you know, what drove, if you could just tell us a little bit about how we got to this point.
Yeah, so my name is Rachel Rockwell. I'm the managing director, pharmacist in charge at Roundtable Rx, and I do have a prepared testimony, so I may as well just go ahead and dive into that, if that's okay.
Sure, yeah, that'd be great. Thank you.
So for those unfamiliar or in need of a refresher, Roundtable Rx operates the Minnesota Medication Repository Program under licensure and supervision from the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. Patient safety is a top priority for our program and operations. Donated products received by our program must be sealed in tamper-evident packaging and unexpired. Of note, we do not accept controlled substances. Our inventory is thoroughly inspected by a pharmacist before being redistributed to Minnesotans in need. Our program continues to grow year after year. Last year, the amount of medications we distributed increased by nearly 100%. During this growth, we have identified areas of this current statute in need of change to improve program operations, increase impact, and enhance access. We are here today to review these proposed changes. All proposed changes have been made in collaboration with the Executive Director and Legal Counsel to the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy and, when applicable, with consultation from DHS. There are three buckets that our asks fall into. The first is to expand the definition of eligible donating facilities. The second is to allow medical assistants and Minnesota Care recipients to access the program. And the third is to reduce administrative burden on the program. In the first bucket, we seek to expand the definition of an eligible donor to allow additional healthcare facility types to contribute, such as residential treatment centers or correctional facilities. None of the safety measures around qualifying donations change. Rather, more types of healthcare facilities would be able to donate their unused quality medications. As demand for our inventory increases, we need to increase our supply of donated quality medications to serve the Minnesotans in need. In our second bucket, we seek to expand access to our program for Minnesota's most vulnerable residents. We are asking for medical assistance and Minnesota Care recipients to be eligible for our program during times of need. We have received multiple requests from our providers and clinic partners for this change, as they have patients who can benefit from the program but are excluded strictly because they have MA or Minnesota Care insurance status. We worked closely with DHS to make sure the wording and allowances were appropriate. Per DHS advisement, this population would not be allowed to be charged a dispensing fee. In our third bucket, there are areas in current legislation that are duplicative and place administrative burden on the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy, the repository program, and our partners without adding value or enhancing safety. As a reminder, these proposed changes were made in collaboration with the Executive Director and Legal Counsel to the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. The changes are intended to reduce excess work while still maintaining all documentation and regulations needed for patient safety. These include reducing the number of times participants need to sign the exact same form, allowing forms to be completed electronically, allowing inventory records to be produced by the repository and not duplicated by medication donors, requiring the repository to maintain all paperwork and to make it available for the Board of Pharmacy upon request, removing the requirement for to issue a program ID card to patients, changing where in the process safety checks by a pharmacist occur, which would be changed from the time of donation to the time of dispensing, and finally allowing clinic and pharmacy partners to dispense over-the-counter medications without a prescription to only qualifying individuals, of course. We hope you will support these proposed legislative changes. Ultimately, the proposed changes are intended to improve access to our program for Minnesotans in need while reducing medication waste and its impact on our environment. And I would be happy to take any questions on that information.
Thank you very much. Members, any other questions now that we've heard an overview? I've seen none. Senator Abler.
This is an example of citizens solving something and being phenomenal. So way to go.
Thank you.
Yeah, it seems like a great program, and it's great to see over time, you know, what you've been able to accomplish, and these changes seem like they would be beneficial. So thank you for bringing them forward. If there aren't any other questions, then Senate File 4584 will be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Thank you. Next, we'll move to Senate File 1303, which is Senator Paz's bill. Senator Pa, are your testifiers here? Please, you can present your bill now. Welcome to our committee. Thank you for bringing Senate File 1303 forward. Senator Pa does have an author's amendment that is included in your packet. It's the A3 amendment. Let's see, Senator Bolden moves Senator Pott, the A3 amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Pott, please proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Wicklin and members. Thank you for this opportunity to present SF 1303, which will support stillbirth prevention through tracking fetal movement. Chair Wicklin, every year in the U.S., approximately 21,745 babies are born still, according to the U.S. Center for Disease Control. Minnesota experiences around 360 plus stillbirth every year. Research states that over a third of stillbirths could be preventable with proper education. With this bill, we could be saving over 120 babies a year in our state. A disproportionate number of babies born still are from BIPOC communities, where maternal mortality is four times more likely for a birthing person if they experience a stillbirth. Research from the American College of Gynecology shows that there are several contributing factors to the racial health disparities in stillbirth, and these include systemic racism in healthcare, leading to discriminatory beliefs, values, and distribution of care to expectant parents of color, access to healthcare early in pregnancy to diagnose conditions and treatments. So what can we do about this? We need to educate expecting parents to count the kicks, or what is technically called fetal movement tracking, during the third trimester of pregnancy. Every baby is different, and we need expecting parents to know what is normal for their baby. And when they notice a change in the fetal movement, We need to encourage them to seek medical care and evaluation right away. I actually had the good fortune last year during my pregnancy to use Count the Kicks. That's the fetal movement tracking tool. Thanks to Senator Pappas, who shared it with me. What a difference this free tool that comes with educational materials and resources had on me and my pregnancy and the delivery of my healthy baby girl. I wish I would have had this tool in all my other four pregnancies. As all of you may know, losing a baby so close to their due date is incredibly devastating. Let's ensure that Minnesota families bring their healthy babies home. In your packet, members, there are letters of support for this bill, some of which are from people and families who have experienced a stillbirth and provided stories explaining why stillbirth prevention action is so necessary. Chair Wicklund, I do have three testifiers today. And then after that, I'd be happy to answer questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And we have, let's see, Amanda Duffy.
Yes.
If you could state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Amanda Duffy, stillbirth prevention advocate. Thank you, Chair Wicklund and the Health and Human Services Committee. My name is Amanda Duffy, and I reside in New Brighton, Minnesota, with my husband and three living children. November 2nd of 2014 was sunny and 70, an anomaly in Minnesota in November. It was to be our last day before my scheduled delivery with our second child. Quickly, that blissfully bright day turned dark when we learned our perfectly healthy baby's heart had stopped beating. My daughter, Reese Christine Duffy, was stillborn. She was 8 pounds, 3 ounces, with red hair like her daddy, a button nose just like her brother, and hands that resembled mine. There are other lost families in this room who are now standing. We demand change. In the weeks leading up to her birth and death, I had noticed Reese's movements changing. When I alerted my provider, I was told that babies slow down close to birth and that I should try to enjoy the last few weeks of my pregnancy. I now know this advice was inaccurate. Never once throughout my entire pregnancy was I educated on the importance of consistently tracking my baby's movements in the third trimester, why I should, or what to do if I noticed a change. So when Reese was born with an umbilical cord wrapped tightly around her neck twice, I was blindsided. With each roll and kick in utero, the cord pulled tighter and she stopped receiving the nutrients her body needed. She slowed down to preserve energy as the blood flow decreased until it was too late. Much like you and I, we slow down when we don't feel well. Our normal movements change. It wasn't until after she died that I learned that sometimes the first and only indicator a baby is in distress is a change in their movements. I know hundreds of Minnesota parents who believe this education could have saved their child's life, and I am one of them. More than 30 states fund materials to save lives. In such a progressive state, why are we so far behind in something so simple, so non-invasive, so low cost, with health equity at the center, and most importantly, so life-saving? Reese should be here today. I shouldn't be sitting here speaking on behalf of bereft parents in the state whose baby's death was preventable, but this is my reality, and I do it out of pure abiding love. I do it because Reese's life matters. I do it because our babies matter. It doesn't have to be this way for the hundreds of others that will follow if something isn't done. On behalf of all Minnesota families impacted by stillbirth, I graciously urge you to pass this life-saving piece of legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your work and for sharing your story. I'm very sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
And now Sheila Kennedy, or is Tessa Fredman, or if you could state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Tessa Fredman. Before I begin, I'd like to thank Chair Wicklund and the Health and Human Services Committee for this opportunity to share my story. Like I said, my name is Tessa Fredman, and I am a Count the Kicks advocate and mother to almost 2-year-old William. I reside in Dayton, Minnesota, and I want to take the next few minutes to briefly share some of my story and my experience using the Count the Kicks app, which is a fetal movement education. I stumbled upon someone on social media who had tragically lost her baby to stillbirth. She explained how she wished she had been more informed about fetal movements and the importance of tracking movement patterns, and how it could have potentially saved her baby's life. It is through her, a complete stranger, a grieving mother, that the loss of her baby that is desperately trying to reach out to others in hopes to prevent what had just happened to her, that I stumbled upon Count the Kicks. Count the Kicks is a free resource available in 21 different languages for mothers to be able to routinely monitor her baby's movements from anywhere. With my son William, I utilized the easy-to-use app, which reminded me daily to monitor fetal movement and patterns. The app conveniently tracks your results each time you use it and stores the data for you to be able to look back on and share with your provider if needed. It helps you monitor your baby's movements, patterns, notifying you if something seems off. I started to track my baby's movements and became familiar with his movement patterns. Around 38 weeks, I noticed a significant drop in movement patterns that were not my baby's norm. Because I had educated myself and researched the importance of the fetal movement tracking, I knew something was not right. I called my OB clinic and they sent me directly to labor and delivery at my local hospital. There, they monitored my baby with non-stress testing and ultrasounds and noticed that my baby was under higher than normal stress. Ultimately, they ended up inducing me that day and confirmed at this point in my pregnancy, my baby would be safer on the outside than in. On the afternoon of May 18th, 2022, my healthy baby boy was delivered. I can't help but think if I had not been properly informed and educated on the significance of fetal tracking, what the result of my pregnancy and my baby's life could have been. I knew there was simply more that needed to be done, which is why I 100% support and stand behind SF 1303, and I highly urge lawmakers to pass this bill. I am passionate about this movement, and I can only hope that someday proper educational resources, such as Count the Kicks, can be in place to help inform moms in the state of Minnesota and get her baby safe in the arms of her and her family. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And this is beautiful
photo of my
William.
Son, yeah. William.
He's very cute.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing. Sheila Kennedy, if you could state your name for the record.
My name is Sheila Kennedy. I'm a certified nurse midwife and women's health program manager at Southside Community Clinic in South Minneapolis. Good morning, Chair Wicklund, committee members. Thank you for allowing me to speak here today. I'm here today on behalf of my patients, my profession, all those who have been affected by a stillborn baby, and most of all, my niece Blair. The most difficult thing I ever have to say to a patient is, I cannot find your baby's heartbeat. I'm always met with a confused look because this is not something any pregnant person expects to hear, nor is it something a pregnant patient should ever hear. So while the news slowly sinks in for my patient, I know the entire course of her life has been completely and devastatingly changed. The leading cause of third trimester stillbirths are problems with the placenta. While we don't always know when there is a problem, we do know that decreased blood flow to the baby via the placenta can lead to altered fetal movement. Fetal movement is one of the best predictors of fetal well-being. Research shows that women whose pregnancy ended in a stillbirth were less likely to check fetal movements and were less likely to be told to do so by their provider. Promoting awareness of fetal movements and prompt assessment of decreased fetal movement has been recommended to reduce stillbirths, yet many providers fail to discuss this with their patients, and too many patients remain unaware of the importance of this. Maternal perception and monitoring of fetal movement is simple, cost-effective, non-invasive, and easily accessible. OB providers and pregnant patients should be more informed on the importance of tracking fetal movement. This low-cost, high-impact intervention has the potential to save the lives of so many babies. Funding this pilot program would mean that every pregnant person in Minnesota would have access to life-saving tools, regardless of race, ethnicity, geographic location, or socioeconomic status. Please pass SF 1303, which helps prevent stillbirths and the crushing heartache that accompanies it.
Thank you very much for your testimony. That's all of the testimony we have. Members, do you have any questions or comments about the bill? Senator Abler.
Someone took my little dealio. I thought Senator Morrison was going to say something, so I was going to defer to her, but if she's not, then I'll just have a few thoughts. All right, well, whatever. So we had a stillbirth late in the second trimester. So So I totally appreciate that. That was our daughter, all boys. And so the different parents have come to me over the years talking about their stillbirths. And if they're preventable, we certainly want to do that. So it's a great bill. And, you know, I would be surprised that the average clinician doesn't already do this. But if there's a bell curve and some people aren't, and if just people need to be enlightened about that, I hope you can find the money and do that. Because it was 33 years ago. And I didn't forget. And so, Madam Chair, just to understand my passion about life that I talk about comes from these experiences which shape me, and we so wish that, I just realized the value. And so I just wanted to encourage the mothers, and I grieve personally for the losses of the people that watch this, and it never goes away. But I tell people to take all the hugs they can get and willingly and freely cry, because it's a big deal. So anyway, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Pa.
Chair Wicklund, thank you. And Senator Abler, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us. I do want to say that we have Senator Morrison, Senator Mann, Senator Hoffman, who are also co-authors on this bill that's in this committee. There are many more legislators that support this bill, but thank you so much for co-authoring and for supporting this.
Senator Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Pa, for elevating this issue. And I'm so sorry for your loss, Senator Abler, that there truly is, in the experience of caring for people during pregnancy and childbirth, there is just about nothing worse than a stillbirth. And so even introducing this bill is important because it elevates the issue, it gets people talking about it. So I'm grateful to you for your advocacy, and thank you to the testifiers as well. Just a thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments? Seeing none, thank you, Senator Pa. I appreciate your bringing it forward as well, and your testifiers are very moving. It seems like a positive thing that has pretty low barriers for people to access it. So with that, Senate File 1303 as amended is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you very much. Senator Morrison will go to your bill. Senate File 3927.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have the A1 amendment that I'd like to move.
Senator Morrison moves the A1 amendment. Members, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The A1 amendment just adds the specific appropriation. Thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 3927, which is about the Rare Disease Advisory Council and funding for it. In 2019, the legislature, thanks to Senator Dr. Mann, established the Minnesota Rare Disease Advisory Council. It was originally housed at the U of M. The Rare Disease Advisory Council represents the rare disease patient communities that, while the diseases are individually rare, to collectively they impact 1 in 10 people in the general population. Rare disease patients have historically been overlooked in our healthcare system, leading to the following poor outcomes. 7 to 8 years is the average time to diagnosis. 2 to 3 misdiagnoses on average before a patient is accurately diagnosed. And less than 9% of the roughly 10,000 rare disease communities have an FDA-approved treatment. In 2022, the state transitioned the council out of the University of Minnesota and established it as a state council, similar to the Minnesota Council on Disabilities. In the 2023 legislative session, the council's base operational budget was established. In coordination with the Minnesota Council on Disabilities and the Minnesota Management and Budget, the council identified an operating budget. Of the requested $654,000, $314,000 was appropriated. So the appropriated amount was significantly lower than other agencies of comparable scope and function. So the council's requesting that the full initial base budget amount be appropriated this legislative session to allow it to fulfill its compliance requirements as well as execute the directives identified in statute. In addition to funding, the proposed structural changes will allow the council to more easily form task forces to address identified areas of concern for the rare disease community. And with that, Madam Chair, I will turn it over to my testifiers.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Ms. Barnes, please state your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Erica Barnes, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Rare Disease Advisory Council. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate File 3927, which would make structural changes to the Minnesota Rare Disease Advisory Council and align its base budget, operating budget, to that of a state agency. The Minnesota Rare Disease Advisory Council is a state agency established in 2022 whose mission is to improve care for the 1 in 10 Minnesotans living with a rare disease. Our aim is to be a comprehensive policy resource for legislators and other state agencies, to provide support tools for the medical community, and be a convener and unifier for the rare disease communities. When the council transitioned from the University of Minnesota, I worked closely with the Small State Agency Resource Team, which is a division of the Minnesota Management and Budget Office, and the Minnesota Council on Disability to identify a budget that would allow us to meet all of our compliance requirements associated with being a state agency, as well as what we would need to execute on our directives that are established and laid out in statute. As Senator Morrison said, last legislative session, the council was appropriated roughly 40% of that base operating budget. There are roughly 7,000 rare diseases, and when these are considered collectively, they affect 25 to 30 million Americans. While the underlying causes are varied, the striking commonality among these diseases are the barriers to care that an individual faces when encountering our healthcare system. At every point along the healthcare journey, rare disease patients face unique barriers over and above those which individuals with more common diseases face. From years-long delay to diagnosis to only 5% of the thousands of rare disease communities having an FDA-approved treatment, it is no wonder that Abby Meyer, the founder of the National Organization for Rare Disorders, once said, "Families affected by rare diseases represent a medically disenfranchised population that falls through the cracks of every healthcare system in the world." And these inefficiencies in diagnosis and management represent a significant cost to our healthcare system as well. A recent NIH cost burden study found that healthcare costs for people with rare diseases are 3 to 5 times higher than the cost for people with more common diseases. Ironically, in the last several years, the rare disease community has become ground zero for some of the most innovative medical advances in decades. Treatments such as gene therapy have opened the possibility of greatly alleviating or even curing diseases which were once out of reach of medicine with a single administration. But these potentially curative treatments come at significant cost. In order to take these transformative therapies from the lab to the clinic and actually deliver them to the people who need it, we will have to identify policies that reshape the healthcare delivery landscape. Already through its brief existence, the council has identified and supported policies that will decrease time to diagnosis, facilitate connections to appropriate care, and restructure our reimbursement pathway. But there is so much more to be done. I must tell you that I am tired of meeting heroes, for which the rare disease community in Minnesota has many. The majority of the nonprofits that are focused on rare diseases in our states have actually been founded by parents, because there was nothing being done for their child's rare disease, just like I did. I established a nonprofit because there were so many gaps and nothing being done for our children. These families do amazing and heroic work. They fund clinical trials, they establish standards of care, they convene the scientific community, often for the first time. So they do amazing and heroic work. But they should not have to be heroes. They should be parents. And I am asking this room and all of you on this committee to actually turn our healthcare system into the hero. The worst thing you can call me when you hear my story is a hero. I don't want to be a hero. I wanted to be a mom. And I know that's true of so many other parents. I ask that you provide the funding that we requested last session and then partner with the council to take the inequitable burden off of rare disease families. Thank you.
Thank you. And next, Dr. David Tilstra, if you could please state your name for the record and begin.
Hi, I'm Dr. David Tilstra. I am a medical geneticist based in St. Cloud, Minnesota, and am on the Rare Diseases Advisory Council. As you've heard from the other speakers this morning, rare diseases are rare as individual disorders, but in aggregate, they are extremely common. And all of us know someone with a rare disease. There isn't a day that goes by that I am talking to someone on the street and they say, oh yeah, I had a child with XYZ diagnosis. Those diagnoses are hard to do, often confusing for providers who don't deal with them very often, difficult for patients who are often feeling like they're being blown off, not listened to mm-hmm. by the medical system, often because the provider isn't. It's not that they don't want to deal with this patient, it's that it's just a challenging disorder and they don't know what to do with it. Payers are also feeling a significant burden because of people with complex disorders. And I don't need to tell you that medical care is complex. We're dealing with the most complex of the complex. And these people are trying to wade through a system that is almost impossible to navigate. It's really a system problem, and we've got lots of advocacy groups out there who put a Band-Aid on things. We find a workaround to get around the problems. What the RDAC does is really trying to figure out what are those system problems and how do we start to address those. And because it's such a complex system, we really need to spend a lot of time and effort on trying to sort this out. And that's really what the RDAC is intending to do. But it needs funding to really get to address those sorts of things, put the effort into building the programs and policies that would help to simplify this extremely complex system.
Thank you. Members, do you have any questions or comments about the bill? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is this money in the tails, or is this just the one-time appropriation? I'm having a hard time when I was looking at this. Do you know offhand?
I think that the intent is that it becomes something that is ongoing.
Yeah.
I mean,
it should be. Yeah.
The amendment makes it ongoing.
Oh, the amendment made it ongoing? Okay. Sorry, I should read the amendment. Thank you, Madam Chair. That was, I mean, this is such an important.
I mean, it's all subject to what we can do this year, but that's, I think, the intent and of Senator Morrison, yeah.
Great thing. I think maybe we should talk because this is the Rare Disease Council and what they're doing at the University of Minnesota is really important stuff. There's some folks there that just they keep doing what they're doing and to see the council here, it's like, you know,
it's important.
Would be I think it's important. So mm-hmm. Thank you. I just wanted to throw that across to you at that one. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions or comments? Question, I guess, so I think this bill, because you want to make changes to the structure of the council, it should go to state government because that's where they, that's in their jurisdiction. So what I'd like to do is pass this today over to them and then you can talk with them about, you know, whether you can get a hearing scheduled. So if there aren't any other questions or Senator Morrison, any final thoughts?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then, Madam Chair, would it come back to us at HHS after state government?
I believe it would. Okay. I mean, I believe obviously the funding mechanism is within our jurisdiction.
Thank you. Yeah. So, Madam Chair, I want to thank the director and the doctor with me this morning who are both incredible. And I think that, you know, if you think about 7 to 8 years to diagnosis, I mean, just think about that in an individual and a family's life alone. Forget the rest of the challenges that go with having a rare disease. We're going to be confronted with really challenging questions going forward with all of the advances, potentially miraculous advances that are already happening, and the council has such an important role in tackling some of those questions. So a final plea to be included in our final budget, but thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Senator Morrison. So Senator Morrison moves that Senate file 3927 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on State Government. Members, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The motion does prevail, and Senate File 3927, as amended, is passed and referred to the Committee on State Government.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Senator Hoffman, you're up. And first, we'll take up Senate File 2960. And I believe you have an A1 amendment.
Madam Chair and members, in front of you is the A1 amendment. I move the A1 amendment.
Members, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I also want to thank my co-authors, Senator Draham, Pappas, Senator Zhang, and Senator Abler. What you did with the A1 amendment is just updated the fiscal year appropriation, which was flagged by staff. Just wanted to make that note. And so in 2022, we passed the mental health omnibus bill, and it helped provide mental health support for teens all over the state. We still need to help those teens. Many emergency rooms are experiencing a huge amount of pressure to try to provide quality care for youth mental health, and you hear about the hospitals and the folks saying when the teens are dropped off at the emergency rooms. And what this does is we can help take the pressure off those emergency rooms and would also provide the necessary services to support teens through this mental health crisis. And with us, Madam Chair, is the former state representative from the other body and current Ramsey County Commissioner, Rena Moran. I'm so glad she's here with us today to give some additional information.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner Moran. Please state your name for the record and begin.
So, good morning, Madam Chair and members. And just want to say thank you, Madam Chair, for having this bill before your committee this morning. So, I am Ramsey County Commissioner Rena Moran, and I'm excited to be here today to talk about the Youth Medical Health Urgency Care Bill. So, the mental health urgent care was born out of a need for non-emergency level care and respite options for youth in a behavior or mental health crisis. In 2022, the legislature passed a $1 million in startup funding for a youth mental health urgency room. Thank you for that. The legislation gave Ramsey County the right of first refusal to take on this pilot project. But Ramsey County accepted the challenge, and we have been working with the Department of Human Services to bring this vision to life. From the start, this team has been committed to engaging with parents and the community. With the help of the Parent Support Outreach Program and St. Paul Public Schools, 261 parents were engaged at school-based events using a survey tool that was distributed in English, Spanish, Somali, Oromo, Mug, and Karen. The survey results reveal parents' knowledge and needs in supporting their children's mental health wellness. So I am pleased to say that Ramsey County Youth Mental Health Urgent Care will open just down the street at 402 University Avenue later this year. The mental health urgent care will serve adolescents between 13 and 18. It will provide family-centered crisis support that is short-term and bridges to longer-term services and other supports as needed. We will provide culturally appropriate, comprehensive mental health crisis services for teens and their families. Residents can expect a thoughtful, comprehensive, compassionate, and family-centered approach to their care from the urgent care team. The initial services included a comprehensive crisis assessment. Families will also be engaged in developing, we will do this with family, in developing a crisis and safety plan. Rapid psychiatric services will be accessible on site. So after the initial visit, the family may choose to engage in an intensive therapeutic intervention plan for 4 to 6 weeks. This service meets them where they are and helps increase their mental health crisis through interventions such as coping skills development, family communication planning, safety planning, and more. And it's really important that we don't just look at the child, but we look at including the family in this dynamic. And if requested, the mental health urgent care will coordinate with other service providers to support the family and will partner with the family to identify which services are a good fit and receive a warm handoff to other services and support. So, Madam Chair, Senate File 2960 requests of $1.5 million per year in ongoing funding to support this important innovation project. While we anticipate that we will be able to bill MA and the insurance company, some of the services for this program that we seek to provide are not eligible for reimbursement. For example, if a young person is in need of a short-term respite stay, we are not able to draw down federal 4E funding. This is because respite stays may take place in a family or kin home or in a licensed home. When respite takes place in a licensed home, the county would need to pay for this. And as you know, our county is strapped because the work that we do is done through a levy. Families in our community urgently need mental health services and supports to help them through a crisis. This mental health urgent care provides an option for families that is not boarding for weeks in a hospital emergency room, simply waiting for a mental health bed to open up and receiving no services or mental health treatment in the meantime should not be an option. So we are proud of this program that we have built, and we hope that you will support it. We just want to say thank you. Thank you for your work, and thank you for your leadership. And again, thank you for giving us the opportunity to do this work in Ramsey County.
Thank you very much. Members, do you have questions about the bill or comments? Senator Abler.
No, it's a good project. I hope you could find the money. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Hoffman, any final thoughts?
Madam Chair and members, I just want to thank Commissioner Moran for her leadership in this field. And even when she was in the other body, I'll never forget, she and I were the only elected officials testifying on the Childhood Protective Task Force, that she actually was one of the founding member of that and really cares deeply about this, and it's deeply needed. And I just am honored to be here with her, and thank you for considering this bill.
Thank you, and thank you for coming today to tell us more about it. It sounds like a lot of good work has been done, and I know there's definitely need for youth and access to services in your county as well as across the state. So thank you very much for coming today.
Thank you.
And with that, Senate File 2960, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you. And then next we have Senator Hoffman. You have Senate File 4986.
Madam Chair, members, there's an A1 amendment that should be in front of you.
Senator Hoffman moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted.
And that was the amendment was needed because the original language was redundant, and we had some work from Christy Grom and the folks at the Department of Human Services to help clean that up. And Jenny Palin and Christy are here to explain this technicality if you have questions, but since you don't, I would just like to get Ben Fiegel and Rosa Talk up here to testify. So with that, members, this will allow the Comunidades Latinos, Unidas, and Servicio Clues, otherwise known as, and I remember 30 years ago when Jesus Villaseñor used to talk to me about clues, Madam Chair. This is really through their certified community behavioral health clinic. And with support from SAMHSA, Clues has developed an outstanding model of services that provide the mental health assessment and therapy, substance use disorder, psychiatric and medication management, targeted mental health, the Children's Therapeutic Services and Support, CTSS, the armed services, which believe it or not, that's an acronym that everybody uses around here, but that means Adult Rehabilitative Mental Health Services, and then, of course, person-centered, as well as the one-on-one services that are there. Federal grant helped Clues develop this model. It's an aspect that's important, and they've been doing this work for many, many years, and they do this that economically efficient, and sensitivity is there because of the significance funding they get through philanthropic sources to improve the affordability of treatment, but now they need our help. And as you know, we've already experienced the big challenges in terms of responding to the huge need for chemical dependency and mental health services, not isolated, but intersectionality together on that. It's an important piece here. And I think this is particularly true for low-income communities. And so what I have here is I'd like to turn it over for some brief comments from our testifiers to really talk about why this is an important piece of our community. So with that, Madam Chair and members, thank you.
Well, welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Patricia Patron. Good morning, Madam Chair Wicklund and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak about Senate File 4986. My name is Patricia Patron, and I am the Vice President of Programs at Comunidades Unidas, Comunidades Latinas Unidas and Servicio Clues. Senator Hoffman, thank you so much for authoring this bill. Clues is Minnesota's largest and oldest Latino-led nonprofit, founded 44 years ago. Our mission focuses on advancing health, social and economic equity and well-being for Minnesota Latinos. Clues serves over 50,000 people on annual basis, employs about 140 team members, most of them bilingual. We engage over 600 volunteers in delivering our work and offer services in St. Paul, Minneapolis, Wilmer, and Austin. Our programs are culturally and linguistically responsive to community needs and designed to empower and engage our community members from newborns to the elderly in holistic and multi-generational ways. We're here to ask for your support of SF 4986, which will help us sustain our mental health and substance use disorder services for the Latino community. Now I'm going to pass it to Ben.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair Wicklund and committee members. Good morning, and thank you to Senator Hoffman for carrying our CCBHC bill. We're very grateful. I'm Dr. Benjamin Feigl. I'm a psychologist, and I'm the Director of Behavioral Health at Clues. In March of 2020, Clues began the process of becoming a Certified Community Behavioral Health Clinic, or CCBHC, with a planning grant from Minnesota DHS. It was a very difficult moment to start implementing a new clinic model as the pandemic started. From the beginning of this process, DHS has been very supportive of Clues becoming a CCBHC, which held the promise of a more sustainable model of providing better access to a broader array of mental health and substance use services to the Latino community. After much work, sweat, and tears, Clues is on the verge of receiving its CCBHC certification, which would provide an enhanced insurance reimbursement through Medicaid. However, the financial projection for Clues in year one of the CCBHC model is far from sustainable because Clues serves a high proportion of clients or participants who are not eligible for any healthcare insurance. About 55% of our participants are not eligible for healthcare insurance. So to be able to deliver on the CCBHC model, which has stringent criteria, CLUES is required to have 9 core services, as Senator Hoffman alluded to, and have capacity for quality assurance, data collection and reporting, as well as compliance infrastructure. This necessitates CLUES seeking out grant funding in the millions in order to survive and avoid cutting the staff and infrastructure we worked so hard to build over the last 4 years. CLUES is asking for financial support from the state to be able to deliver on the promise of increased access to sustainable behavioral health services for the Latino community, and also to help reduce the financial and operational burden on state systems and others by preventing the need for higher levels of more expensive mental health and substance use interventions. We know that community-based interventions help prevent the need for people going to places like inpatient unit, detox, higher, more expensive levels of service. CLUES is unique because of its challenging payer mix, but most importantly, because it provides culturally responsive services to the Latino community, regardless of insurance eligibility. I can attest that recruiting and retaining bilingual, multicultural staff and leadership is a significant challenge for a nonprofit like CLUES. All CLUES staff are bilingual and multicultural and reflect the community we serve, thus bringing a sense of belonging and healing to Minnesota's Latino community. We urge your support for CLUES to receive a direct appropriation of $1.5 million in funding from the state of Minnesota to ensure the sustainability and infrastructure of these essential behavioral health services for our vulnerable communities in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And I also have on the list Rosa Talk. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you very much, Chair Wickland, and good morning again and to you and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rosa Tok, and I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify this morning in support of Senate File 4986. I'm sorry, but I've been having a little bit of a problem with my throat this morning. So, as you heard, Comunidades Latinas en Servicio, or CLUES, has a long-standing reputation and a proven record to deliver holistic services that are culturally and linguistically responsive in the area of mental health. It is encouraging for us, for the community, that CLUES wants to bring these kinds of services to the next level. As previous testifiers explained, the pilot model that CLUES is proposing will help mitigate behavioral health disparities for vulnerable communities, especially those that are uninsured and underinsured. As Ben explained, the pilot project aims to demonstrate how preventive care reduces costs related to expensive interventions and how the sustainability of their community behavioral health clinic will ensure access to essential community-based services. Mental health challenges continue to be prevalent in the Latino community. Through our various community listening sessions across the state, there are persistent issues that we hear affect their well-being, especially after the COVID-19 pandemic that disproportionately affected our communities. For instance, access to affordable health care, lack or scarcity of qualified medical interpretation, and mental health concerns among children, teens, parents, and workers. Also, studies consistently show that barriers to mental health care for BIPOC groups include financial, geographic, cultural, and linguistic obstacles. We believe that with the right culturally responsive and preventive interventions, such as the ones proposed by CLUES, many of these barriers will be eased for vulnerable populations. So for these reasons, committee members, the council strongly urges the adoption of this innovative bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, do you have any questions or concerns or comments about the bill? Seeing no questions, Senator Hoffman, any other thoughts that you'd like to share?
Yeah, the history of CLUES is beyond, and to, for them to step into the integrated health, the CCBHC model, is just absolutely needed, deeply needed. Here's a word of thought for you, Madam Chair. In November of 2023, there was $84 million of underspent money from our wonderful Department of Human Services, right? And then that was moved into the general fund at $84 million. Just think, if we had a contingency account set up at the Department of Human Services, there would be no need for CLUES or organizations like that to come to us requesting that with a contingency, there would be money available that already was put in there. I just want to give them food for thought on there, as maybe there might be a theme this year on how do we capture some of that money. So with that, Madam Chair and members, thank you. Doctor, thank you. Rosa, thank you for being here. And thank you, Senator Torres Ray, who is a big help in this as well. So thank you.
Yeah, I really appreciate you bringing the bill forward. I'm really the model and the pilot project and the work that's gone into setting this up is really extensive. And it seems like a real... meeting a real key need in our communities for more access to the mental health and chemical abuse services, but then also just the way that you've been able to establish a staff that is brings the cultural competencies to it, and the bilingual staff is really seems like a really important step that we can take to support people. So with that, Senate File 4986, as amended, will be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
And Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senate File 3372.
Madam Chair and members, this is Senate File 3372, which is the county-administered rural medicine medical assistance model, also known as CARMA. And so I want to thank Senator Utke, Senator Nelson, Senator Housechild, and Senator Kupek, the Hartford Whalers, for being co-authors on this bill. And so, members, the current county-based purchasing, or CBP, statute that was passed by a bipartisan coalition of legislators in 1997. County-based purchasing is a successful local county-owned and operated model that's been addressing the needs of public program enrollees in rural communities. While the county-based purchasing plans have had legal disagreements with our department in recent years, but they've also been engaging in real collaboration with the department aimed at doing better together for the people they serve. And so this bill before you reflects the conversations that the county-based purchasing plans, the Association of Minnesota Counties, and the department have been holding over the past year, and it requires our commissioner to work collaboratively with counties during the interim to develop details of a county-administered rural medical assistance, or CARMA, model, and bring back recommendations to the legislature in 2025, including a plan and model legislation. This bill is not only an opportunity to move past recent legal disputes over current state law, but I think it's an important ability to build on the success of the county-based purchasing through the greater alignment and collaboration that we have to do out there. More importantly, I think this bill gets the innovation toward an improved and strengthened county-based model that would further integrate county public health and social services to address social determinants of health and deliver those better outcomes. So I have Goodhue County Commissioner Brad Anderson is here, and I think you should have a CARMA handout, correct, Brad? Did you or Matt Freeman? So you got Matt Freeman and Brad here, but with that, Commissioner Anderson. So.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming today, Commissioner Anderson. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Chair Wickman and committee members and Senator Hoffman, thank you for the opportunity to address this bill. I'm Brad Anderson, in my 10th year as a Goodhue County Commissioner and my 10th year as a South Country Board member. I serve on the Finance Committee, Quality Assurance Committee, Utilization Management Committee at South Country. To say commissioners are passionate about this work is an understatement. I want to touch on 3 points related to this bill. First, why counties? Why this bill now? Rural health outcomes are unique require a unique approach and to address the social determinants of health. It requires integration of the health plan with the county public health and human services programs. This collaborative, coordinated, and integrated work between groups of counties and the health plan ensure all needs of the enrollees are addressed, whether that is access to local providers that the health plan works with, or it is addressing housing, food security, or transportation, or any of the 40 or 50 programs that the county public health and human service department deliver for the state of Minnesota and the federal departments. Yes, we are investing in our citizens in so many ways. We've been doing this work for 40 years at the county level, and yes, we care. That's why we are here. We strive for a person-centered continuum of care, and the integration with the health plan is a large part of that work. County-based purchasing litigation. I've done it. I don't want to continue to be in the position to have to choose it again. It is not fun. It is not the way our citizens want government to work. I'm convinced no one truly wins in litigation. It's a waste of valuable resources. Let's address the issues and move forward. Finally, this bill is outcome-driven with the right people at the table. The bill is looking at opportunities for better outcomes, not focusing on barriers. I applaud the recent mediation team for initiating the framework to build on, and Commissioner Harpstead for supporting this endeavor. We have individual counties, groups of counties, AMC, and DHS all working over the past year to move this forward. Beyond that group, CMS will be involved as we collectively and collaboratively work through this initiative. The counties, state departments, state legislatures, and federal agencies working collaboratively is what our constituents and our county citizens want on so many important issues. We got this. I'm confident this will yield positive results and build a better path forward. So after a year of meeting, we are here looking to you as leaders to support this effort and take this to the next level and build for the future of rural health care. Please support this bill by initiating and embracing the collaboration of our units of government. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Freeman, please state your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Chair Wicklund, Chair Hoffman, and members of the committee. My name is Matt Freeman. I'm here to testify on behalf of the Association of Minnesota Counties, where I serve as the Human Service Policy Analyst. AMC, on behalf of Minnesota's 87 counties, wants to urge you to support Senate File 3372, the County-Administered Rural Medical Assistance, or CARMA, Development Bill. While not as flashy as the Taylor Swift song Karma, we think it can be very impactful. The bill offers the opportunity to collaboratively flesh out the details of a new and improved county-based model. The legislation is a result of a year-long process of collaboration, as you've heard, between AMC, CBP plans, and cooperation with Department of Human Services. AMC and the county commissioners who manage these plans are excited about working with DHS on this, and we're hopeful that the final proposal will really highlight and build on 40 years of success of CBPs at innovation, responsiveness, transparency, reinvestment in rural healthcare infrastructure, increasing access to care, achieving better outcomes for enrollees, and administering managed medical assistance in a cost-effective manner. AMC and its commissioners know the importance of local county-based care delivery, of integration with county services, and partnering with our local providers and supporting our local communities. It makes for great care and outstanding outcomes for those we serve. So to quote Taylor Swift, me and Karma vibe like that, and we appreciate your consideration and your support for Senate File 3372.
I'm loving that. That's great, Matt.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Freeman. Members, any questions or comments about the bill? Senator Rutke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not going to even touch the references to Taylor Swift because I can't compete. But anyhow, just thank all involved for bringing this forward. It's nice to see that we're moving something like this in a positive direction. County-based purchasing has done such a great job for us in rural Minnesota, and they've been, over the years, working with a number of challenges that weren't really needed, but at least at this point, we're seeing a positive path forward, and that's great news because they not only are involved in just the medical care or limited care, they're involved in the total spectrum of care. In our rural areas, without them, we'd be missing a lot. So most of it's been covered. I just thank you guys for what you've been doing, and hopefully we can find a way through. I guess I did have one question for Senator Hoffman. Under the appropriations, do we know yet what we're looking at?
Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair, members, I think the department, to facilitate the process, there's going to be a cost for facilitators, $100,000-something, right? I think it's about $100,000, might be $150,000.
Well,
cost of a facilitator, madam.
Figuring out what the costs are.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's hopefully we can find a way to get this off the table and move forward, so thank you.
Right. Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Senator Ebler.
Thanks, Brad.
This is a really good.
He's the same, too. But the county-based system has been really phenomenal in the last picture because clinicians have been remarkable. I think are enviable.
Sorry, had that off. It's a really good bill, I think it will make quite a difference as we try to put more gas on the fire of county-based purchasing. Madam Chair, I had occasion to go to a meeting last night in stark contrast where Alina is choosing to close a pediatrics thing at Mercy and close the OR and the ICU. I mean, okay, it's supposed to be a business decision and it's all going to be great, but they never talked to the doctors and the nurses beforehand. And when they were queried on at this town hall meeting, they said, well, did you, doctors, there are more doctors and nurses that came to be concerned about this, where they saw the loss of capacity. And when this doctor said, we never had a meeting with you, and they said, well, we were required to inform you. You've been informed. And so that would never happen at the county-based level. And so as we try to build a system and think, where are we going? Particularly in the medical assistance population and Minnesota Care and all that, where they can get everything together. That's the model we want, I think, and not just a get over it kind of thing, which I see happening and as we get more and more consolidation. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair and members, the person with the checkbook at the department is saying that I was wrong on the numbers, and I think that we'll figure that out. Then again, as long as we're informing people, I wonder if Matt Freeman came by, Madam Chair, and made reference to Taylor Swift, because in Cannon Falls in Goodhue County, Nirvana was the famous band that got a picture taken at Pachyderm Music Studios, one of the top 100 music studios in the nation. And so I wonder, Brad, is that why you got Matt Freeman to do that? But with that, no, in all seriousness, the county-based stuff, Madam Chair, is a good thing, and I'm glad we're hearing this bill, and I'm glad we're having this conversation. And thank you, Commissioner, and thank you, Mr. Freeman.
Thank you for presenting the bill, and thank you for bringing it forward. I think it is something we need to continue having discussions about, ways to improve our overall healthcare system in the state, and so I appreciate the ideas brought forward and that the department is working with the counties and there's this active effort going on. So we will get more money or get more information about the money needed for it before we decide on our omnibus bill. So with that, Senate File 3372 is laid over for possible inclusion. And next we have Senator Kupek. Senate File 4341. Senator Kupek, I see that there is a A1 amendment. Would you like to move the A1 amendment?
I would, Madam Chair. I'd move the A1 amendment.
Members, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. Thank you. Go ahead.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And the A1 amendment, while it is a delete all, it is just kind of a technical fix, and working with council was just easier to kind of do it this way. So that is why. And the amendment just kind of gets in line after talking to the department, just some wording that they thought would clarify things. So that's what the amendment goes to. So what we have here before us in Senate File 3341 will provide resources to ensure that child care providers in Minnesota are trained to deliver quality child care programs and to ensure that Minnesotans have the best daycare experience they have. After listening to providers, they say that staff development is one of the biggest challenges besides the funding need for wages to work and retain their quality staff. So this would provide grants to those child care centers to provide further education for their employees.
Great. And I have, there's a testifier who is on Zoom, Nicole Flick. If you can state your name for the record and begin your testimony. Thank you.
My name is Nicole Flick, and I own ABC 123 Child Enrichment Center in Dilworth, and I am a leader with Kids Count on Us. On behalf of Child Care Center directors across the state, we want to thank Senator Kupek for his overwhelming support for child care and our littlest Minnesotans. We are begging people to come and work in child care for little money, no benefits, and very long hours, most of the weeks with overtime. We have offered incentive after incentive to get educated people to choose our industry, but they don't. They choose the public school or private nanny. Why? Higher pay, benefits, tuition reimbursement or forgiveness, and resources for children who need help with mental, social, or physical development. When parents bear the burden of paying the entire cost of care, the resources are few and far between in the childcare industry. The pipeline for qualified teachers is extinct. Until this industry is treated like a career and we attract professionals, we will always have a childcare crisis and no qualified teachers to employ. This bill is one small step to invest in our current teachers and give them an education that is not only approved by the state of Minnesota and DHS, but also the ability to learn the best practices for working with children in this era of mental illness, PTSD from COVID, and children with behaviors. It takes years to learn how to best cope with a classroom full of 3 to 5-year-olds who each have their own developmental setback, such as speech delay, fine motor, large motor, or developmental delays. The average length of employment at my center is 4 months. Why? Not enough education or resources on how to handle the severe behaviors of the children in their care. The CDA, which is a Child Development Associate Credential, is a method that teachers can become lead teachers in a classroom without a college degree. It includes 120 hours of training in classes, the completion of a professional portfolio, work with a trainer learning coordinator to get hands-on feedback in addition to a final exam. Hiring qualified staff who are educated to perform the critical tasks of childcare is increasingly difficult and expensive. It's the number one reason for wait lists in centers. We simply do not have enough trained and well-compensated staff to provide care and learning. CDAs do not have standard costs, but generally are in the range of $1,000 per teacher. With possible additional expenses and ongoing costs to renew the credential, while this may seem inexpensive in a field where the operating margins are extremely low, CDAs are actually very costly and are being borne by the providers and sometimes teachers themselves. Here's a snapshot of the numbers from 3 different providers. Last year, I spent $3,700 to help staff cover CDA costs. Another provider in the metro has six staff paying right now to get all their CDAs at cost of families of $1,000 per person when you include the testing. Once they have their CDA, it needs to be renewed every other year, also at a cost. Another provider in the metro includes staff who do not speak English as their first language and are required to do additional classes to get their CDAs, and they need interpreters that cost $35 an hour. That provider has spent over $20,000 to get teachers their CDAs. Grant money to pay these costs would enable us to save the money we are currently spending on this to be used for our kids and families. As you can tell, the per-person cost to help fund this is a small investment from the state, but a big deal for teachers and providers. Even a modest investment from the state will come with significant returns for the staff and the children they teach and care for every day. It is with great certainty that I recommend this bill to be passed and money appropriated in the hopes of making the childcare industry a career, and furthermore, not making parents pay for this via higher tuition with already outrageous childcare costs. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Flick. I really appreciate your taking time out of your day to present your testimony. Senator Kupick, I think that there's another resource in the room if we have questions. But members, do you have any questions about the bill? Senator Utke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a question, Senator Kupick, on the amendment, because with the bill, the original statute that it affected was covered both center-based and family child cares, in-home child care. And now the new section seems to be more school age. Just kind of wondering the thought process there, because it seems like a lot of our shortages is with the younger children, finding a place basically babies up through three-year-old, and this now is moving that to the older kids.
Maybe we can draw on our resource. Ann McCulley is here. Ms. McCulley, if you could state your name for the record and answer the question. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Wicklund and Senator Utke. My name is Ann McCulley, and I'm with Child Care Aware of Minnesota. We are the implementers of what's currently the CDA scholarship program. Senator Utke, I don't think it changes the age group. The original bill was drafted to go out through the regional child care resource and referral or Child Care Aware agencies, and this particular grant program is funneled just through one agency, which is our office, but it's still, we currently do fund both centers and family child care programs and funding infants and toddlers all the way up through pre-K. So I don't know why the reference necessarily says school age, but it's the statute that allows this funding to pass through to that program. And maybe somebody from the department can answer better than that. But.
Senator Utke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then just one final question. We all fully realize we need all the help we can get for additional child care. What type of, it's still got an open appropriation. What is the targeted amount or the hopeful amount for this bill?
Senator Kupick, do you have any estimate, or is this a scalable proposal?
It's scalable, and I think, in the realization of, that this is not a budget year, I think it was kind of left open for discussion. So, but
I can just give one piece of context, which is that the current program is funded with Federal Child Care Development Fund money, and we spend only about $40,000 a year. So it could definitely use more, but it is scalable in the infrastructure. So you were so kind last year as to pass funding for both the Teach Early Learning Scholarships and the Retain Grants. The CDA scholarships come out of the same group of people, so we've got the infrastructure to hit the ground running. It's just the dollars to be able to support more providers like Ms. Flick.
Thank you.
Senator Redke.
Thanks.
Any other questions? I don't see any. Thank you for that information. It does seem like a really critical need. If providers are not making salaries where they are going to go out on their own and gain additional skills at their own cost, which doesn't make sense, I really think this type of bill where we could help more people attain those credentials would be really worthwhile. So thank you. Any other thoughts, Senator Kupick, before we lead the bill over?
Sure, Madam Chair. I would just say it's just one more little just tiny piece in the whole puzzle of trying to, you know, get adequate child care funding for the state of Minnesota.
Thank you. And with that, Senate File 4341, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you. And then, Senator Kupak, you have Senate File 4390.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. We'll shift gears here a little bit. This has to do with technology for our counties. So, as you know, last year we did a whole lot to help improve the technology at the state level for DHS for a lot of their programs. I remember sitting here listening to testimony about the program was 1991 that was being masked with a GUI. So we provided some money to help upgrade that. But that also has to trickle then down, certainly down to the county level as well. So our current human services information technology complex is somewhat fragmented and burdensome too often. It prevents outcomes Minnesota's need for their critical human services program. Unfortunately, modernization efforts have not kept up with that rapid changing technology. And as I mentioned, the last session we provided a lot of money. This file, Senate File 4390, is a natural next step to the DHS service delivery transformation we funded last year. Article 1 would provide $5 million to cover county costs of aligning with new state systems and require the state to develop a framework that offsets those county costs for the implementation of future IT or service delivery. Article 2 allocates $50 million in one-time funding for counties to modernize their technology platforms and encourage collaborative projects. Understand these are big numbers to be throwing around in a year that is not much funding available, but I hope this hearing at least will shed some light on that and also provide in the context, too, that a lot of when I talk to, you know, the people who are out doing the work, a lot of the part that they find the most frustrating is the paperwork part of it. And if we can improve the technology to allow them to make that part of the job easier, it is a big reason that they go, oh, I've had enough. I just want to help people. I don't want to fill out paperwork. So if we can streamline that in any way, shape, or form, I think that's a good step forward.
Thank you. And welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman Lewickland and members of this committee. I am Jody Brennan. I am Scott County Commissioner. I'm also the mother of an adult who receives services. So I know both sides of this and both the public and private, privately. On behalf of the Association of Minnesota Counties, I'm pleased to be here to testify in support of Senate File 4390, which you, as heard from Senator Kupik, would make critical investment in county technology systems. I want to stress that this request does not reflect nice-to-have updates for the counties. These resources are needed to bring county programs up to a basic level of operability. County IT modernization has been identified as a top priority for the Association of Minnesota Counties because it touches on some of the most critical issues facing counties today. Chief among those is workforce. Requiring county employees to navigate green screens and manually enter data for hours does not lead to high satisfaction or retention rates for individuals who have studied and whose passions in working directly with children and families. Recruiting our next generation of workforce becomes even more difficult when our technology systems predate the birth of our new workers. Even more importantly, these outdated systems created a cumbersome and inflexible experience that is simply incompatible with how families and individuals live their lives. Asking individuals, or in my case myself, to fill out separate multi-page forms for duplicate information for SNAP, housing assistant, healthcare, and childcare, all because they live on different technology platforms. When the rest of the world can autofill by to buy a car, rent an apartment, or a pair of shoes. It just seems that there's no better way. There has to be a better way. Finally, county workers spend hours entering information on children, individuals, and families. Why is this? In theory, it is so that we as elected officials can analyze an effectiveness of programs and feel confident in our investments. I'm preparing for this, for coming here today. I asked my staff how many people that we serve, and that information, which you would think would be very basic, was actually very difficult to obtain because different systems had to go in, they had to go into and figure out how many people they had duplicated throughout those systems. So a real comprehensive, easy answer was very difficult to get. Many counties, if they are able, have developed their own way to work around this. Scott County invests millions of dollars in staff training, document management software, and other last mile solutions to try to give consumers and workers the best experience possible. This legislature has made significant investments in state-level technology modernization for human services systems. However, counties cannot access these funds. Counties and individuals we serve need state investment to create a level playing field for all counties and to be able to serve people better, create reliable data sources for lawmakers to evaluate programs, and better protect the data for all Minnesotans. Thank you so much for your time this morning and consideration of this vital issue.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Jensen, if you can state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senators. My name is Dan Jensen. I'm Associate Director for Olmsted County Family Support and Assistance. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of SF 4390 on behalf of the Association of Minnesota Counties, the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, the Minnesota Inter-County Association, and Olmsted County. Collectively, these organizations recognize that modernizing state technology and developing local systems are a top priority in order to support our workforce and the people we serve. While we had a similar legislative priority last year, we chose as counties to focus on supporting and advocating for the $200 million investment that was made in state-level IT systems. For that, we thank you. As a tri-chair of MACSA's Modernization Committee, the Human Service IT Alignment Group, co-founder and past chair of MCCC's Human Service User Group, we have used these platforms to strengthen our partnerships with DHS. And collectively, we are emphasizing a person-centered approach to systems modernization. Unfortunately, along with the state software needing modernizations, counties lack several core systems, and that results in a significant imbalance between what's happening at the state and the last mile of service delivery at the local level. Counties lack systems that coordinate cross-program services. The most simplest, what's an unduplicated client count? What's the average number of cases or programs our clients are on? How long have they been on our programs? What's the first program they come into? What are the outcomes? We can't answer those basic questions because of how our systems are designed and set up at this point. We also lack the ability to communicate effectively using modern approaches with our clients. We can't coordinate inbound applications, and we can't measure the service impact and effectiveness. And as you heard, last year's funding, while it was a great step forward, cannot be used to address these county needs. There is a handout in your packet showing the technologies that are county operated and county funding. Exacerbating this state-to-county imbalance is a county-to-county digital disparity. Individual county-developed tools, we share them, but it's really difficult to implement them because of the differences in our systems, in our local systems, in our local security and the software we use. All of those things make that very difficult to develop something in one county and then share that and redeploy that in another county. This funding will assist us in executing several multi-county projects that are in design and even some that are shovel-ready but lack funding to execute.
In conclusion, we recognize that state resources are limited. However, modest, one-time investments will make the difference to reduce the state-to-county imbalance and bridge the county-to-county digital disparity and create that foundation that we can start to begin to build off of. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your testimony, and thank you for the handout. I think it really does illustrate the complexity of what the counties are dealing with. Members, do you have any questions, comments? Senator Ebler.
Well, thanks, Madam Chair, and Senator Kupak, and to the testifiers. This is really a big need. Just I have advice, if you're going to find this kind of money, your target doesn't seem quite that big. But if Senator Kupak, if you keep beating this drum, and I hope you do, I think the language needs to be clarified a bit. This gives with all respect to the department, it doesn't discuss what their percentage would be to administer this, how complex it would be. And I would suggest if you're going to bring this forward that you tell them what you would like. And I don't think they'll mind that. So if you give a formula and then out it goes with much less stuff. Otherwise, you have RFPs, delays for any amount of time. And all it does is aggravate both the department and the people as they're waiting for the money to go out. And so, you know, you could decide if you wanted bigger counties get more. There's a certain like what's worked well in the past is like a base amount that some little county go like, well, that's a lot of money, and a big county goes like, really? And then you do this little base amount and then a per capita or something. But you're on the track. This has to get done. And so good luck on that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Ebler. Any other comments? I'll just add, I mean, I think it is essential that we really continue to work diligently on this. I really appreciate that the counties have set up, the working groups and they've done a lot of work to help understand, you know, how to manage some of these IT projects in a way that would be, you know, most doable for the counties, and they're ready to work with DHS on how to make that happen. So I think we really do need to look for ways to you know, address the funding so that you can move forward. I think we've heard a number of times this session about initiatives where we want to improve the child welfare experience, we want to improve child protection, but it all keeps coming back to systems that are just really, really challenging for the workers to use. And as you mentioned, then that makes it difficult to retain people in these fields where we want them to be helping children and families. So I appreciate you bringing the bill forward, and we'll continue to look at see if there's any possible way this year, but hopefully you'll keep working on it too so we can keep it moving forward. So thank you again for coming to testify. Any other comments? Any other final thoughts? Senator Kupak?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Thanks, committee. Yeah, it is not, it's certainly not a super glamorous issue, but I think he really gets at the base of, you know, where all our workers out in the field, what we could do to make their lives easier and modernize things and get also data that we need. It's crucial, so thank you.
All right. Thank you. And with that, Senate File 4390 is laid over for possible inclusion. And with that, members, we've reached the end of our agenda, and we are adjourned. Thank you.